What's up, everyone? Welcome back to Golden Hour, a podcast about Asian creativity in music. I'm your trusty host, Charlene Kay, and I don't know about you, but I am personally riding real high off of this past Oscars weekend and the incredible sweep that Everything Everywhere All at Once was able to achieve. I'm so psyched for Michelle Yeoh. I'm so psyched for Kei Kwan. I'm psyched for James Hong. I am so proud to be Asian, and it's such a great time to celebrate being an Asian creative. I really feel like the tides are turning, and I've never seen anything like this before, so I feel very tender that my younger self gets proven wrong. And I'm so honored to play my very small part in amplifying these Asian voices on this podcast. Today, we have an incredibly special episode with my dear friend, Connie Lim, a Chinese-American singer-songwriter, fearless activist, and total rock star who makes music under the name Milk, which is spelled M-I-L-C-K and derived from her name. Connie has been making music for most of her life, but her big breakthrough moment was writing a song called Quiet that she wrote about an abusive relationship she had as a teenager and which, years later, went super viral at the 2017 Women's March.
I can't keep quiet.
The song's virality led to her being the subject of a bidding war with major labels, her eventually signing with Atlantic Records, and her going on to create incredibly powerful work, including writing songs for John Legend and Hamilton's Philippa Sue, and one of my personal favorite songs of hers, We Won't Go Back.
We honor those who fought before us. They give us strength as we push forward.
Which is about her reaction to the overturn of Roe v. Wade, and which I was lucky enough to perform with her at the MoMA the day after this episode was taped back in September. We recorded this episode in person, and the second Connie walked through the door into my apartment, it was kind of like we had always been close friends. It was very uncanny how much we already had in common. We were already laughing like sisters and had inside jokes within like 2 seconds. It is such a gift to have her in my life. She has such a gravitas about her that is balanced out with this joyful lightheartedness, which we talk about plenty in our conversation, and I really just think the world of her, and I'm so excited to share her story with you. We also have the honor of her giving us a special acoustic performance of her new single, Animal, live from my bedroom. So without further ado, here's my episode with Connie Lim, aka Milk.
I can't keep quiet.
We are sitting here in my studio today with the fantastic Connie Lim, aka Milk.
Yay! I love it in here.
Welcome, Connie. How are you doing today?
So good. I'm surrounded by beautiful interior design right now.
Ah!
So I'm just feeling like very luxurious
and
like a queen of sorts.
So. Oh my gosh, I love that my space makes you feel like that.
Yeah.
That makes me really happy to hear.
It's so important. I used to poo-poo that stuff. I was like, I'm so functional and hardworking and like can just survive off nothing. But now I'm like, no, screw that. I want like luxurious beauty around me all the time.
Yes. I want everything I see to give me joy.
Yes.
And it influences everything else. So let's start at the beginning. I want to hear about your upbringing, how you got started with music, and then, you know, we'll get into a lot of the juicy stuff that makes you such a dynamic artist.
Well, thanks for saying all of that. I'm so happy to be here. And I've been watching you from afar as an LA girl, watching this New York musician just
an LA,
be a badass.
But British.
Yeah, yeah. So the feelings are very mutual. In terms of my beginnings, music was my like third, I call it my third language. So there was this event that occurred in elementary school where they pulled me into a room, the school staff, and they said, we want to see if you're ESL, which within itself was like, why me? But okay. So then they like, this teacher was holding up pictures of objects and telling me to name them. And so then I was naming all of them. And then she gets to a picture of a sandwich. And so she's like, what is this? I was like, it's literally a sandwich, but I thought, is this a trick question? So I said, it's bread, it's meat, it's lettuce, it's tomato. And they're like, ah, she doesn't know the word sandwich. And so they put me into ESL for a bit. And my mom was like, so worried. She's like, oh no, it's because I taught you Chinese first. And now you're like ESL. And so then she freaked out. And so she's like, okay, home is Chinese only zone. You cannot speak any English. And then outside of home is English only zone. You can't speak any Chinese.
Whoa.
Just so that I could get practice with Chinese and get practice with English. So it was very like, it was like zoned. But then in the car rides between school and home was Stevie Wonder, Elton yeah. John, like music, bass lines, kick drums. And like, I didn't have to be Chinese. I didn't have to be American enough. Like it was just... it was a place where I could transcend without even realizing I was transcending the borders of English only, Chinese only zones. Yeah. And then I started understanding that I could write poetry and then I could mask my protest, my true opinions behind music and I wouldn't get in trouble. Like, but if I said it naked at the dinner table with just the words and my opinions, I would maybe get in trouble. But with music, it was all kind of masked. And I learned from like Marvin Gaye, John Lennon, like watching these artists, I was like, oh, this is cool. They're singing about intense stuff, but there's a beat and there's a melody. So somehow we can still talk about it. So music was a tool to one, transcend, and then two, protest and speak my truth in spaces that I felt like I couldn't.
Wow. So even from a very young age, you were already writing protest music.
Yeah, I guess so.
Were you protesting against being grounded or what were some of your first protest sentiments?
The first like super emo, like my first pop song was called Every Breath. And it was like, the thought of staying with you, it creeps. It creeps. I can't believe I still remember
yes!
it.
Oh my
but
God.
It was talking about like how I was suffocating, you know, like so teenager. Like, no. Yeah.
Listen, my first song was called Blatantly Unbent.
Oh, nice.
I was trying to be Alanis Morissette and just use as many big words as possible. It's so, when something is so unbent that it's blatant. It's
like, I love it. There's like the alliteration of the B, you know, that's nice. It's pleasing.
That's very generous of you. I'm a poet. I was a young poet.
Such a poet.
That's amazing, though, that you already had that inclination to speak up for yourself. And it's so relatable growing up in a Chinese household, even though my parents didn't require us to speak Chinese. There was such a sense of this is who you are. This is how you must act. These are the boundaries in which you can exist. And I'd love to know how your music developed after that and when you started to write and what was that like with your family and was there any conflict there?
It's so interesting because I've been really grappling with how our Asian American community feels about the concept of model minority. And this all ties into like my journey with music and my parents. Because there's like feedback I get from some friends, like, oh, I'm so tired of this, like this idea that I've been gaslit into. I was like, oh, that's a really interesting way of putting it. Cause it's true. I even feel like with my own family, I feel like we're kind of like gaslit into this like idea of what we should be, but we really weren't. Like my mom is super loud and opinionated, but the idea is that the woman, like she would even say to me, like women with small mouths and big eyes are more attractive because they're speaking less, observing more. But I was like, but you're not doing that.
Yeah.
But we had, I don't know what everyone's experience is. I all like know is my own. I think my mom, even to this day, I think there's a part of her that like loves that I do all this. And then the part of her that's been kind of socialized is like really worried and concerned that I do this as a living. They were very against it. There, you know, it went straight to the stereotypes of like musicians all do drugs and, you know, like,
I mean, my mom still thinks that.
I mean, I smoked the ganja, but
I'm just kidding. You heard it here, Mom. Wow. Yeah, yeah, I feel very kindred with you because not only are we the same age, we're both Chinese American, and it sounds like we've had such similar experiences growing up. So please continue.
Yeah, and both my parents actually grew, like, they've experienced a good amount of like struggle and poverty in their own lives, and then it's interesting because my dad did forge the quote unquote whatever the old school American dream was, going from like having nothing to building his own ecosystem of health and wellness and like abundance. And so as I watch our nation grapple with like the idea of model minority, it's like, what does model minority mean? And like my father's path of being able to succeed in this paradigm that is the United States, I've been thinking about all of that a lot because it gives me privileges. I grew up not worrying about financials at all. Yeah. Only when I left my path of academia, then I was on my own. I wanted to make those choices and kind of like prove to my parents that I could do it.
Oh,
but I remember graduating from, I went to UC Berkeley, and they're like, okay, you have 1 year to show us that you can be a professional musician. Did you get 1 year too?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And then every year after that, it was like, okay, fine. One more year. But after this, you really have to wake up. You have to get real.
Yeah. I'm 36, y'all. Mm-hmm. And my mom is like, you know, you're going to have to wake up. Like, yeah. I'm taking a long nap.
Yeah. It's so, I hate that. It's so condescending in that way. Cause it's like it's as if you've been asleep this whole time. When in reality, this is what gives us life. And we are the most awake when we're in touch with our creativity and speaking to what's happening in society and trying to improve it.
That's really well said. Yeah, I think that there was this one article of an up-and-coming Gen Z Asian femme artist who was saying the fact that I can be creative is a sign that my family has evolved, like, because I can now be creative. They couldn't.
Yeah.
Makes me think of Thich Nhat Hanh. He has this one poem about walking, and he says when he walks, every step he walks, for his grandfather, for his like ancestors, because they couldn't walk with leisure. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't something they valued or could do.
Yeah.
So he's like, I do that for them. Mm-hmm. And I think when my mom says these things, what I feel is like a sense of just like extreme gratitude and also sadness. I'm grateful that like she and my dad have given me a life where I'm able to now forge ideas as a living.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you and I get to express ourselves and get compensated for it in this crazy world. Mm-hmm. And then I also feel like it's this like acknowledgement, kind of a humbling acknowledgement. Like my mom can't even wrap her head around the idea of making one's creativity and feelings a source of power and income and stability.
It's so true. And I know I've spoken about this in previous episodes, but it's not like our parents don't have those artistic impulses within themselves. They just haven't had the resources or the cultural like acceptance to pursue those further, because like you said, it is very fortunate that we're able to do this. And with my mom, she literally couldn't, because it was a matter of survival.
Yeah.
And there were more pressing things to think about, like when they were going to eat, and they were in the middle of a war, and I can see in some ways how they would consider this a more like frivolous pursuit.
Yeah. And I remember doing a whole exercise with my therapist, which again, also like very blessed, to have,
oh, we love therapy,
to embrace frivolity, like,
yeah,
to,
yeah, yeah.
So she's like, okay, what are the things that you think are frivolous? And this is like a few years ago. I was like, butterflies are frivolous, like those butterfly jewelry, butterfly things. I was like, and then so she's like, maybe you need to have like a new relationship with butterflies. So then I like put a lot of drawings of butterflies all over me, like, okay, what's so bad about this? Like, why can't I have frivolous beauty in my life too?
Yes. Yes.
And what you said about like, just our parents not being able to have the time or energy to be creative like we were able to, makes me think about my new like fantasy. So I feel like every 5 to 10 years or so I develop a new fantasy, and mm-hmm. so this one is the idea that we have a globe covered with communities of people that are all well rested enough, well fed mm. enough that they can all tell their own stories and be creative.
Yes.
They think the, and so that's a radical idea because of course there's so much suffering in the world, but I try to envision that, like people mm-hmm. in Hong Kong and Guatemala, all over, like Ghana, just communities of people who, yes, are working for their lives and building it, but also having time to tell their story.
Absolutely.
Because I feel like it's so healing. I think there's been research done. The act of telling one's story and sharing one's experience can help decrease the amount of inflammation in our body. So like prejudice and oppression causes like stress. And so a lot of bodies like will have acid reflux. Like, I mean, during pandemic, I think the increase of acid reflux, like people's internals are literally heating up and like feeling so much turmoil. And so the act of storytelling is something that immediately lowers that heat.
Oh, that's so resonant with me. I think that this is important for me to express and like reiterate, especially on this podcast, which is uniquely about heritage and creativity, that the more that I am creative, the more that I'm able to tap into my own spirituality and the more I'm able to fill my cup and mm-hmm. leaning into things like that are frivolous, mm-hmm. like making chuggy signs for my recycling bins, allowing yourself to enjoy those smaller details,
yeah,
even if they're not consequential, does make a big difference in the overall picture of your well-being. And it seems like, I'm so glad that you mentioned therapy, and it seems like you have such a lightness about you and you have this mischievousness about you, which I think is so important, especially mm-hmm. getting older as a woman in music. Mm-hmm. We have to think of other ways to sort of make the system work for us. And I've been enjoying figuring those things out and figuring out what delights me and amuses me, and finding, ironically, that if I tune out the noise of what the culture wants and what the culture is telling me to do and just listen to myself, that's what actually resonates more. So right. It's been an interesting journey of that.
That's really powerful. I totally relate to this, what you're talking about in terms of like trying to find our way, continuously find our way in an industry as women of color, and also women in their 30s. Like, how do we want to take up space in the industry, and like how much of it do we focus on? Like, what are our metrics for success? So I'm constantly battling with my, I think, ancestral, I'm just gonna blame my ancestors for this. Take that, great grandpa.
Well, they're listening, so
yeah. Sorry, not sorry, but you gave me scarcity mindset, and
just a very Asian thing as well.
It is. I mean, one of the beautiful things is that I'm so eco-friendly. I will reuse Tupperwares. I will those little details that I learned from my family in terms of saving and being very mindful. I do think it's beautiful for the planet, and then for my mindset in terms of like income, money, how much do I save? Will I be okay? Am I going to survive in this world? Like, how many risks do I take? How much do I invest in myself? Like, all of that, like the idea of being confident with money is so revolutionary mm-hmm. versus like being safe with it. Mm-hmm. Like, how much danger can I enact with it and play with finances?
Yeah.
Because art takes money. Like,
it does.
And even if we're producing an directing our own stuff. Like I saw you built concepts for your last music video. Like even if we do that, we got to invest in ourselves, like training ourselves. It still takes resources.
You became pretty well known for a viral moment in which your song Quiet became the official song of the Women's March in
2017.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Remember those days? and it was so, it's been so amazing to see videos of that time and how the song totally took a life of its own and seeing people all around the world singing it. Mm-hmm. So I want to know what that experience was like for you. What was it like when you were writing the song, and what was it like the day that you discovered that it was really taking off?
When I was writing the song, it was like a need. Like I had this unidentifiable tension in my body and in my mind because I hadn't expressed this particular feeling yet. And I had tried to write it in different songs. Like I wrote one song about like asking my, it basically let me cry was the whole concept of it. Like, don't tell me not to cry. Don't suppress me, that, but nothing was quite hitting. And I was going to therapy then, learning that the abuse that I had gone through as a young adult, that, or as not an adult, actually as a teenager, was not my fault. And so I think once I learned it wasn't my fault, all of this information started unlocking. I think my brain was then like, oh, it's safe now for you to like think about these things deeper because you're not going to blame yourself. So then all these dreams started happening. And there was one particular dream where I was getting hit by my abuser. And then there was someone watching from the side. And I keep these people anonymous because they are in my life. And so the observer says, or I look at the observer and say three things I had never said before. First was, this isn't right and I need help. And so, and then the observer said, well, if you say anything right now, you're going to make it worse. So just keep quiet for now and it'll be over soon. So I looked at the observer and said the third thing, which is, well, I can't keep quiet. So then I woke up from the dream like, oh man, that was really, really intense and it felt real. So I went to my writing session. I happened to have a writing session scheduled with this incredible writer, producer. Her name's Adrienne Gonzalez. I told her about the dream and then she helped me identify I Can't Keep Quiet is the chorus. So then once that happened, the song unlocked and it felt like I lost 20 pounds, like this like weight in my chest. I was like, and I, at that point, what was popular, it was end of 2015, like Chainsmokers were really popular then, like a lot of dance music and like stuff like that. And so I was like, no one's going to want to listen to this song. I love
that that's the reference for the time. That paints a perfect picture.
Yeah. And so I was like, I don't think anyone wants to hear this. Like then, releasing it as that feeling of protest, like I can't keep quiet. One woman riot. Like that feeling was able to come out of me. I felt this release. And then it was a year later during the Trump and Hillary campaigns that I felt that same feeling start coming up. I was like, oh, this feeling is very similar to how I felt when I wrote Quiet. So I kind of like instinctively matched them. I was like, okay, maybe I should share this song.
Yeah.
I got dropped by management. I was getting like a lot of doors closed in my way. So I had nothing to lose. And so when the song went viral at the Women's March, I had told myself before it went viral that no matter what happens with this song, I've done my best because I literally flew across the country, recruited strangers to sing this song with me. It wasn't for anything other than like, I want to offer something to the Women's March.
Yeah.
I don't want to just march. I want to give a gift to the marchers. And like one of my favorite things is harmony.
Yeah.
Because harmony is so healing. Like the physical repercussions of standing like amidst a choir is so real.
It really is. The vibrations.
Yes. And I learned to trust myself when I started singing in choirs because I was like, okay, I'm going to sing this note. Someone else is going to sing another note. I have to trust that I'm going to stay on my note. Yeah. And I have to trust that person's going to stay on their note. And then we can make something beautiful together if we just like do our own things, but do things together, which is such a deep metaphor, of course. So I was like, I want to give like a sonic sauna to all the marchers. And I had been feeling quite alone in my process. Mm. And so after we had done all the flash mobs, the song hadn't gone viral yet. It was just like, we did it and now we're marching. And then I was standing by the stage because after we finished marching, we stopped at a stage and I was listening to the speakers and I was like, what have I done? I've just spent like hundreds of dollars and I'm like almost broke and I'm out here. And I remember looking up at the sky and being like, okay, shush, like you've done everything you can. So if the world wants the song to be shared, you will get a sign. Then like 6 hours later, it was like Deborah Messing's retweeted and people are like, oh. Hey, like I saw you on Deborah Messing's. I was like, what are you talking about?
Wow.
And so then I realized that someone had filmed and their video went viral.
Yeah.
And then I think the deeper things that I learned from that moment was one, like when we really follow that instinct in us to do what we really want to do, like we follow that, if we're blessed to feel that and hone our ability to feel those instincts and we follow, things do work out. Not all the time, but they do work out. And I felt like a bigger power kind of going on. Like I didn't grow up religious. I didn't grow up thinking that there's a bigger power, but I felt something. I was like, oh, this is as if my whole life flashed before my eyes. It was like all these things I experienced have led to this moment. Because now I'm seeing choirs all over the world translate into their languages, sing in their own languages. And the resounding message was, you are not alone.
Yeah.
Like, and your feeling of feeling so unheard is so universal. So it kind of like broke me open, that song, because then I started seeing like, oh, a lot of people can't keep quiet. Oh, what can they not keep quiet about? So then I went on years of just learning and trying to understand like how to be a part of the positive movements towards healing. So yeah, I think it was all very reassuring because I feel like more and more people are telling their stories. And again, it goes back to my fantasy of having like a globe covered with well-rested humans that can tell their stories. So I know, like, yeah, because I feel so much better when I think about that, when I like visualize that versus like thinking about how effed up things are, because that's also true. But I just want to give like 60% of my thinking to what could be.
Absolutely. And nothing happens if we don't imagine it first.
Yeah.
So yeah, from there, things snowballed pretty fast. You signed a record deal. And what was that ride like after you realized that it was a phenomenon?
It was all the things. It was so much. It was to the point where like every moment of my waking day was scheduled because there was so much coming.
Yeah.
And then I was also resharing my story of trauma over and over again and singing the song that helped me heal from it over and over again. And then like meeting new people. And I went from being an indie artist working with like one other person who dropped me to then working with 20 people. So it was a lot of change. And I eventually got burnt out, I think, because this is part of, I think, my like Asian heritage coming out in the way of my own experience, is that I was so grateful and proud to get to a certain point of being able to sign with the major label and like break a lot of barriers, that I was like, time to work my ass off. Right? This like, I'm so grateful, lucky me type of idea was still in me. Like, I wish I could say like I reacted a different way, but I had spent most of my career being told I should go back to China. It might not be like feasible for me to make it out here. Asian artists aren't quite like a compelling artist. Like, I mean, these were things that were being said 7 years ago, and now things have changed so drastically. It's amazing. So if anyone's listening to this and like, kind of hearing it in disbelief, like that's a good thing, because as a lot of things feel like they're breaking down, other things are being created, and there's definitely like more lanes for Asian artists right now in the United States.
Holy shit. As you said, you were being told go back to China. That just hit me in so many different ways, because We've been told that in a derogatory sense on the street. Mm-hmm. Like, I've heard that in terms of like harassment and fetishization. Mm-hmm. But what you're talking about, which is also true, is this very practical consideration of going to the ancestral land that our families come from, where we don't have the same type of connection because we might have a better chance of making it there. I'm doing air quotes, because we look like the people that live there, as opposed to being in the minority here, which is fascinating that you just told me that.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating. It's like when I was just even a few years ago, I had an idea of doing a family album. Like I wrote a song for my dad, my mom. It's my story. I want to share it. And I was the people receiving my pitch said it's not universal enough. And like literally the titles of some of the songs were Oh Mother.
So that to me seems like you got some pretty different feedback once you were more well known than before when you were an indie artist working with a
team. I would say it happened both sides. Mm. So the comment of universality was after the Women's March. And so it was after I had Reputation. Mm-hmm. It still didn't, I think the tragedy of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor had not happened yet to help force some mainstream gatekeepers to really look at how they talk to people of color beyond like Black communities. Like, how did we talk to Asian communities? How do we talk to Indigenous communities? Like, that just wasn't even there even in 2019.
Yeah.
You know, it really was like, again, like the Black leadership of social change continues to set the bar.
Yeah.
In a way that I really admire. And I think it's shifted things.
Yeah. And even so, we're still fighting as much as we can to be taken seriously. And we're the same age. We're both in our mid-30s. And it's pretty amazing that you were able to see that shift in global recognition in your 30s as an Asian American woman.
Oh, yeah.
Not someone who was 18 or 19. This is something that I'm thinking about a lot as I get older and thinking about the type of music I want to make and how I want to present myself, how I feel most at home in myself. And I think that when you are, when you're in your 30s, you just know yourself so much more. And I'm curious, when you were in your 20s and making music before you had that hit, was there a part of you that felt like it made sense in a way that you'd been working towards that?
I love that question because I think it gives me the space to explore how surprised I was that my that moment of success came from something so authentic. So that's the good news, is that it wasn't like some hit song that I co-created with really famous producers and really famous writers that have written lots of hits. Like, it was a song of my own yearning to be heard with a producer who was also up and coming, who she believed in me. And I think there was a couple of things at play that made that moment birth. Was one of the main things was that Adrian believed in me. She looked at me in the eyes like countless times and said, I have no worries about you. I believe in you. I know you're meant to do this. Like, three things I had never heard before, especially being an artist.
And it's like, so hard to get yourself to believe that. And like,
yes. So I clung to her belief, and then that helped me succeed. So when you like asked me if there's a way that I expected it, I think because I had such good support from Adrian and my therapist, and at that time my ex-fiance was such a beautiful source of support for me, it makes sense. I finally had this feeling of being supported no matter what. And it made me feel pretty invincible in lots of ways. It's interesting, like, being an artist, there's part of me that, you know, I've seen those funny memes about the existence of an artist's mind. Half of it is like just purely insecure, and the other half is like confident. Mm-hmm. And when I'm in a writing room and I'm writing a song and I can feel that knowing, like, I'm supposed to do this. Like, I just know it. But then when I release songs into the market and, like, experience Spotify and the numbers, like, all the numbers that track everything we do, that's when all my insecurities can come up. And I have to really battle with that.
And it's so it's so significant that a song that you wrote that sprung from trauma and from your subconscious that you actually had a dream about and brought in to somebody who was able to hold space for that and not question it was what ended up resonating, because that was your soul.
Right. I have goosebumps thinking about the power of listening well. Like, the better that we can listen well to each other, the better the stories we're going to be able to tell. Adrian was able to listen well so that I could fully just expand my truth. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like there's an opportunity for all of us to, like, listen well. I feel like listening is one of the sexiest, like, listening well is one of the sexiest traits in a human being, and, like, desire for growth. Those are, like, my two favorite things in people. I'm like, ooh, you know how to listen, and you know, and you want to grow. Like, I'm in.
Absolutely.
But especially this time when there's lots of assumptions that we make about each other based off of our beliefs or where we live or what political party we tend to relate to more or stuff like that. But there's, like, this space in between that is this radical listening that I think could help ease the tensions and, like, help us be better as a community together.
Absolutely. Because you're putting your attention outside of yourself and you're allowing someone else's experience to flow through you, essentially.
Yeah.
And in this age where we're all conditioned to have such short attention spans with social media and TikTok and more and more short form content taking up our screens, it feels like a rarity to have someone that will hold space for you like that. You have this lightness about you, and you've been through some shit. I've seen that, and I almost kind of feel like people who have been able to process difficult things through deep friendships and art, and ideally through therapy, feel I feel like those are the people that have access to so much joy as well. But because you've talked about this in other interviews, I'm curious. You speak a lot about coming from an abusive, having abusive experiences in your childhood that led you to write songs like I Won't Keep Quiet. And I was wondering, as much as you're comfortable talking about it, if you would feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, like what my experiences were. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine is not, I don't know if anyone would center like a movie around it or anything. It's not very like crazy dramatic, but the effects of it were super intense. So I had, when I was 14, I started dating a 17-year-old who eventually turned 18 as our relationship progressed. He was, and I think is still, very troubled, and has his own demons that he didn't know how to process. So he would get drunk and then he would come into my backyard and knock on my window, and threaten to yell to get me in trouble with my parents if I didn't let him in. And so it was this continual push, like, if you don't do this, I'm going to do this. And he started throwing objects. And so I remember the first time he threw his car keys at me and it whizzed by my face. I was like, okay, I just need to, like, get really small and really quiet and just don't, like, trigger the bomb, you know, don't trigger the landmine. So I learned how to just become like a puppet, essentially, which is, like, so sad. Like, I think about that, like, how I like left my body and then made choices to appease him. So I got kind of trapped. And then when I told my family, I didn't even know that I was getting forced. Like, I didn't know that that was like a form of sexual assault, like that's domestic violence. It's that's rape because he was my boyfriend, you know, and I chose that. I chose that guy. And I chose to let him in my window.
Right. Like, so it must be my fault.
Right. And so when I
told 14 years old.
Yeah. So I told my family and the pain, and they couldn't see that it wasn't my fault. Now there's like cultural blindness. Oh, there's all that stuff. Like Amanda Nguyen, the founder of Rise, talks about this a lot. She talks about how there's a lot of slut shaming going on in the Asian community, traditional Asian communities too, that we need to just talk about and address and not shame. I don't want to shame them for doing that to me. It's just, okay, this is a learning opportunity, because like then for 10 years after that, I thought it was my fault, which then what the repercussions of that were huge, because then I started identifying with the truth that like, or the non-truth that there's something wrong with me. I attract bad things. Like I can't be trusted. The act of like getting shamed for something that wasn't my fault essentially like ripped me from my own self-trust, which is like what harmony and singing in choirs helped me physically regain, a trust of I can sing this note and other people can sing their note and I trust myself to make this music. And then eventually I had to go to therapy to integrate trusting my own truth again. I can't just express that and feel that in music. Like, I wish it were enough, but it's not. Like, we need help with therapy. So it's one of those things, like, it wasn't like someone grabbed me from the street. It was one of the more quiet ones, which is what more of the common, that's the majority of domestic violence or, you know, sexual assaults happen with people that we know.
Yeah.
So that was the, Mary Oliver has this quote. It's like, I'm going to butcher it, but I'm going to try. It's, someone once gave me a box of darkness and it took me time to realize that this too was a gift. Mm-hmm. So that's when I got my gift, like from that troubled man or trouble. Yeah. Cause then he was a man. And at that point it was like.
And you were a girl. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, he was still young. I mean, he was a legal man, but he was emotionally still so damaged and probably still is. Like that that journey of taking safety from him took years for me to finally be able to escape that relationship. Years.
So, oh.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that you went through that.
Oh, thanks.
And I can also see the ways in which it's still hard for women to not minimize our experiences, and even though you say it's not worth a movie or something like that, it's still valid. And
maybe
it's still
it is
like
worth a movie. Maybe you're right.
Well, it was all chemical for you, and in reclaiming back that power that came roaring out in other ways that eventually led to your voice as an artist being so formative.
That was a really formative time.
Yeah. Was that linked to your eating disorder as well?
Absolutely. I think the eating disorder stemmed a lot from cultural upbringing as well. Like, I'm trying to be mindful of not perpetuating stereotypes of like Asian families are this way. This is just my family. So like my parents are boisterous in their own way and break a lot of stereotypes in their own way. And then there were some rules that we all thought we had to follow of what like a woman needs to be, even though like none of us were following those rules, but somehow I needed to be like a certain way in order to attract a male for security, like that type of thinking.
Because it's the most important thing to attract a man.
That's the
end goal.
Well, what I wish I was told instead was, you're so capable of taking care of yourself, period. And the messaging, even if it was unintentional, was you're gonna need someone to take care of you. So you need to do these things so someone will come take care of you. And so the word capable is so important to me. And I'm trying to reform my relationship with it because I spent too many years thinking I was not capable. And I wanted to go back to what you said about joy. What I have found with the majority of people who have been doing activism work, working with like sex trafficking, like the heaviest of heavy, they're so joyful and light. Mm-hmm. Wearing polka dot dresses. There's this one woman who helps like sex trafficking survivors, and she just has this knowing. But it's like there's something that unlocks within us when we face the troubles of the world, is that there's like another door to just like infallible joy, you know? And I want to be that like old lady that just like is just laughing and chuckling, but I've also seen like some shit.
You've seen some shit. Yeah. And it's because we've seen some shit that we can laugh. Because we can know that nothing can really touch us after that.
And appreciating the beautiful moments.
Yeah.
Because we've seen the other side.
Yeah. Would you be interested in playing a song for us?
Yeah.
We don't do this very often, so it'd be such a treat.
This song is my latest release. It's called Animal. And it felt like a really nice song to follow up We Won't Go Back, which I knew was going to be a polarizing song that addresses my reaction to Roe v. Wade. Animal is like pretty universal, and it felt nice to just think about my wildness. I hope when people hear it, they can allow themselves to transcend like the constrictiveness of the current environment that we are all living in. Here we go. Everything's alive and wild and dying. There's beauty in the sweat, the blood and the crying. I played house for a while, and I got lost in the trying. Since I was a child, I've been fighting. Our stories and plans are so defining. The future and the past are both bad timing. Blindfolded promises and our eyes to make it last. Couldn't marry him that fall. The leaves were changing, reminding me that I am an animal. My words undeniable. A miracle. A mess, ethereal, blood and flesh. I am an animal. Ooh. vision of us.
So wonderfully eloquent and transparent, and I just admire you so much, and how much you care about your work and how much you care about others and how those two intersect.
Intersect.
I'm stumbling over my words. I've so enjoyed this hour speaking with you, Connie.
Me too.
And I wish you the best of luck, and thank you for being on Golden Hour.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you again to Connie for joining us on the show today. You can find her on Instagram at Milk Music. That's M-I-L-C-K Music. Her most recent EP, The Machine, is available now. Please subscribe, follow, and rate the podcast on whatever platform you listen. Your engagement really helps us make the show better. And we love hearing from you. Tell us what you think about the show and who you'd like to hear from in future episodes. Send us a message on Instagram at GoldenHourPod. Or email us at goldenhourwithk@gmail.com. Golden Hour is created by me and produced and edited by Dave Yim. Gabriel Hunter Chang is our production associate. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.